Hey, you guys are checking out the Solo Monster Sound Off podcast. This is Brian Cage from Selfless Wolverine. Give him a listen, check it out. Take care, guys. Who better? Nobody.
Forgive me, Mr. Engel. I don't think that we've had the pleasure of being properly introduced. So please allow me. My name is Loser!
Run.
It's business time, baby.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Shout out to John Loose Cannon Lopez for getting Brian Cage to give the Sound Off a shout out last night's All Pro Wrestling show in California. Apparently he also liked our Rumble Like It's 1992 shirt that John was wearing. They are up in our store, for those of you who are interested. The Swolverine, that's what he calls himself. It's funny, you know, that used to be my nickname back in college. I don't like to brag or anything, I'm just saying. Hey, it's episode 494 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, May 7th, 2017. I am the Swolo Monster. Boy, do we have a lot of news to get to, including a little Twitter spat involving Rebbie Hardy and Karen Jarrett. The Broken saga continues. We'll get to that and everything else. But first, we set our all-time Audible record for the month of April, so I have to thank you guys for really killing it with the link. Now let's do it again in May. You can use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Get yourself a free audio book as part of your 30-day Audible trial. A lot of you have cashed in on the new AJ Lee book, Crazy Is My Superpower. All, 8 hours or 11 hours, I think, of narration by AJ herself. So you still have time if you want to check out that book. It's gotten some glowing reviews. I actually got a tweet from somebody last night. Somebody sent Bob Holly a tweet, tagged me in it, telling him that they used our link to download and listen to the Bob Holly book, The Hardcore Truth, and they loved it. I loved it too. I did a whole review on it. It's up on our YouTube channel, and I had Bob on the show, which was one of the best interviews I ever did. People loved that interview. So there's a lot of books you guys can take advantage of if you want to. All you got to do is go to audibletrial.com/solomonster, sign up for the 30-day trial. You do have to sign up. You will not be billed if you cancel within those 30 days for any reason. And if you do, you still get to keep your book. So it's a win-win right there. audibletrial.com/solomonster, the Justin Roberts book, Best Seat in the House, is supposed to go up on Audible any day now. You'll be able to use our link for that one as well. So definitely support the show in that way. Could also become a PayPal VIP. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout out. Really, any donation will get you a shout out, but $10 or more, you'll get the nickname. You can donate on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right hand side of the page. That is the way to go. You can suggest your own nicknames, by the way. I feel like I've got nickname fatigue. I've come up with every possible combination of nicknames I can. But if you want to make a suggestion of your own, there should be somewhere when you make the donation, like a notes field or something. If you don't see any field or notes box or anything, just email me after you make the donation and make sure you put PayPal somewhere in the subject line and let me know. And if it's not already taken by somebody else, you can pick your own nickname. Thank you to John Luis Cannon Lopez, who I just mentioned, got us the Brian Cage shout-out last night. Luis Cannon, we have Out of Control Cody Thomas. We have a lot of familiar faces here supporting the show here this week. We have Yvonne Bruiser Balak. We have Beast Mode Brock Joseph. We have Luis Hercules Hernandez, the Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Hytham the Equalizer Al Nawasser, CJ, Ring the Bell, La Chapelle, Master Technician, Michael Paez, Anthony Gorilla Press Gonzalez, Massgrave, Micah Harshaw, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, American Misery, Jordan D. Paola, The Chapel Hill High Flyer, Kyle George, The Sin City Superstar, Peter Sanders, Codebreaker, Christopher Tominey, Real Rock and Roller, Ryan Hodge, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Glorious Glenn Warnicki. Glenn, if I'm botching it, I'm sorry. I went back and forth whether it's Warnicki or Warnecki or Warnick. I should have asked you, but anyway, you get a shout out here, my friend, so thank you for the donation. Manny the Missile Bernardino, the Belgian Brute, Nicholas Overmeer. Also want to say happy 16th birthday to the Scouse Smasher, Peter Fitzsimons. That's from your brother Patty, and from me as well. And Joshua Boom Boom Bryant, who wants everybody to check out his, well, it's not his, but it's called This Is Progress. There's a This Is Progress documentary being funded on Kickstarter as we speak. They've got a bunch of incentives they're offering, including a 2-hour training session with none other than Matt Riddle, who, if WWE has any sense about them, will sign this guy up very soon and make him one of their top stars. So you can check out the campaign right now on Kickstarter.com. If you can't find it, when you search for it, let me know. I'll send you the link. There probably will be additional donations here as I get going here on the show. So if you have not heard your name yet, do not fear. Keep listening. I promise I will get to you. But we'll spread things out a little bit here. Also, shout out to Ben Tagg. Ben Tagg put together that Bray Wyatt compilation video that I asked for last week, if you remember that. I tweeted it out. I tagged Matthew from Botchamania. He loved it. The video's got something, last time I checked, like 25,000 views. Also, I want to give a shout out to St. Clair Isuka. He also did a video of his own. But I knew it would be funny, that's why I asked for it. I wanted to see somebody put it together, but it's more eye-opening, I think, than anything else when you really, you see these clips of all of Bray's spooky promos immediately followed by clips of him losing. The eater of pins, as somebody in the comments said, I love that. I think the part I love the most about Ben's video is when you see Bray talking about eliminating like 29 other men, 29 other souls or whatever from the Royal Rumble, and then immediately you cut to a shot of Big Show and Kane literally carrying Bray's dead carcass over to the ropes and just very casually dumping him out to the floor like a sack of trash. Oh my God, that really sends it home for me. But as I said on the podcast months ago, Bray is pretty much the reverse Undertaker, at least at WrestleMania. It's really sad. Last Sunday was WWE Payback. If you want my full Payback review, it is up on the YouTube channel. You could also download the MP3 there as well, so go there for my full thoughts. I did a whole 40-minute review on what I thought overall was a thumbs-up show. I thought there was some really good matches on the show, also some not-so-good stuff. By the way, this YouTube adpocalypse stuff that everybody's been talking about, it's real. Okay, when you have a video that does 25,000 views and it makes a whopping 89 cents in ad revenue, that's pretty bad. That's pretty bad. So thankfully you guys are really kicking ass with Audible and the PayPal donations, because otherwise that'd be a pretty crappy time for me. Final poll, by the way, the Twitter poll I put up for Payback, over 3,000 of you voted, 67% thumbs up, 33% thumbs down. So you guys were pretty much in lockstep with me in thinking overall, not a perfect show, but you seem to be pretty happy with it overall. You should see some of the comments that I got from people for saying that I enjoyed the first half of the House of Horrors match. It was hilarious, and I'll say it again, I enjoyed it. See, I'm making funny faces, you can't see right now, but I am. I enjoyed it. The fact that the crowd crapped all over it means nothing to me. They crapped on it because they were forced to stare at a screen for 15 minutes, that's why they crapped on it. And that's the risk you run when you pre-tape stuff like that. My only criticism, if I have like a major, and we could pick out the things like, you know, why was it shot in the dark when it was supposed to be live in California? Yes, that was stupid. Why was Randy Orton, you know, he had a almost like a scruffy beard or stubble when he was in the house, and yet when he was in the arena he was clean shaven? Yes, we could talk about all those dumb things, quality control that WWE should have thought about and did not. That didn't take away from my enjoyment of the match, but yes, I am with you. That was dumb. But the big criticism, if I had one about like the first half of the match, is the same criticism that Jerry Lawler had. Because on his podcast, Lawler said that what he didn't enjoy about the House of Horrors match, which he said he was really looking forward to because he, like me, is a big fan of horror movies. And he thought it wasn't scary enough. If I could change anything, I'd have had them really make it scary. And I get it's PG and you have kids. Who cares? They'll get over it. You can make it scary without using blood and guts and gore. I'm not saying go full Walking Dead here or turn it into a Saw movie. But it could have been scarier. You know, dolls hanging from the ceiling is not exactly my idea of being scary. It's a little unnerving, I guess, but not exactly scary. So that would be my criticism of it. I would have had, like, you know, somebody in a sheet mask do a jump scare when Orton goes to open a door or something. Or Orton, you know, walks into a room and sees the latest episode of Impact on TV. Like, really scary stuff. That would be my only criticism of it. Otherwise, I thought it was fine. The first half of the match, I thought, was enjoyable as something different. And maybe that's why I'm taking this point of view on it. And people find it so frustrating. Like, why? They can't understand why, Salamaster. Why are you praising this? I think more than anything, I like it when they take these things out of the arena. And they do this. And I'm not saying they should be doing this every single month, but it kind of goes back to when they had the hardcore division back in the Attitude Era. I really enjoyed it when they would brawl in the back and they would brawl out of the building. They would brawl across the street like they did that one time at SummerSlam into a bar. Literally across the street, incoming traffic and everything. Al Snow almost got run over by a car when they wrestled into the Mississippi River, him and Bob Holly. Or even like the first Boiler Room Brawl with Undertaker and Mankind. I like stuff like that. I like it when they take it out of the ring, when they take it out of the building. One thing that kind of annoys me is, you know, every now and then, they'll have one of these Falls Count Anywhere matches in WWE. And I would say 9 times out of 10 or 8 times out of 10, they don't really take full advantage of the stipulation. And that annoys me as somebody who enjoys it when they kind of go outside the box a little bit, like literally outside their little sandbox. Because it's like, dude, you can do, you know, pinfalls and submissions count anywhere. Why not go into the back? Why not, you know, end up in the men's locker room or better yet, the women's locker room and brawl in the back and you see everybody kind of scattering in the background or brawl into the friggin' bathroom or something like, you know, Benoit Sullivan did in WCW. I feel like, you know, WWE doesn't really take advantage of that stip when they use it. So I just enjoy it when they do that because it's something different and it's fun. And that's what I appreciated about this, cheesy as it may have been. So there's at least something of an explanation for why I might have enjoyed it more than most people seem to have enjoyed it. And the other reason is I was a hell of a lot more entertained by the first half of this match than I was their WrestleMania match. I thought their WrestleMania match sucked. So there you go. This was a step up from their WrestleMania match. Let's talk about Sean Waltman. This was a big story this week, and I have to follow up on this because I mentioned as I was recording last week, Sean Waltman was missing. People did not know where Sean Waltman was. They were starting to freak out, especially given his history. They didn't know where he was. He had no-showed a UK date that he was scheduled for. Nobody had heard from him. So your mind begins to wander based on this guy's history. You hope he's okay. You just hope he's alive. Turns out he had a very good reason for no-showing the event. In the UK, he was arrested at LAX trying to board his flight to the UK and was charged with 5 counts of possession of narcotics intended for sale. Drug sniffing dogs detected something in his bags. He had already been on a watch list with customs, so they pulled him aside to check everything out. They emptied his bags. They detained him for hours. That's when they claimed they found 15 white methamphetamine pills, 23 multicolored methamphetamine pills, 2 THC liquid cigarettes, 56 THC capsules, and 3 cannabis chocolate bars. Boy, they really do come in all kinds today, don't they? Chocolate bars, really. That reminds me, I was at a friend's house once, and I saw that he had gummy bears sitting on the table. And so I reached for one of the red ones, because I like, you know, red gummy bears. And he sees this and he says, like, no, don't eat that. And I'm like, why not? He goes, those are pot gummies. So I'm like, oh, Well, thank you for telling me. So it was a close call there. But I really did want that red gummy. I was kind of pissed about that. But anyway, according to a report from PW Insider, which went a little more into detail here about this stuff, Waltman told them being the agents, he had planned to return to LA in a couple of days. So this was not going to be a very long trip. And between the quick turnaround of the trip, coupled with the number of pills that they claim he had on him, plus the $700 cash he was carrying, they determined, based on all of this, this was evidence of narcotic sales. That's the leap that they made. And to make matters worse, once they took him into custody, they realized that he had an outstanding warrant stemming from an earlier DUI case. Actually, two outstanding warrants. They learned of another one out in the state of Pennsylvania, where I believe Waltman lived up until last year. I think now he's out in California, but he had lived in Pennsylvania. He had an outstanding warrant there as well. That was for a February 2016 drug arrest, where he was charged with possession of marijuana and driving without his headlights on. So I guess for that, he was put on probation. I believe that case, he said that case closed about a month ago. So I'm not exactly sure why that would have been flagged here if that case was now officially closed, but it was. So this whole thing is just a gigantic mess. And you know, using the stuff, you know, basically they say, you know, he was busted for marijuana and meth. And, you know, it's one thing to use the stuff. Using the stuff and selling the stuff are two very different things. If you think, you know, if they think that you're trying to smuggle drugs out of the country with the intent to sell them, that's really bad news. Like, really bad. Now, Waltman went on his podcast. He's got a podcast every week, I think every Wednesday, called X-Pac 12360. He gave his side of the story. He says he was not selling it. He does not sell drugs. He said he's never sold drugs to anybody. He's given some drugs away to some people, which I'm sure happens a lot more than we may think. But he's never sold it. That's what he said. He claims he was stopped at the gate by customs agents when he tried to board his flight. He admitted that he was carrying marijuana-related items. He did cop to that. They searched his belongings. He claims that he heard one of the lead agents say, "We gotta make this look good," as they were going through all of his stuff. He says he saw one of them jump for joy at one point after they tested something from one of his bags. He says there was no methamphetamine pills in his bag. He didn't have meth. He wasn't using meth. He wasn't carrying meth. He wasn't selling meth. That's what he says. Even though the agents apparently claim that there were a number of meth pills in there. So either he's telling the truth and he's being framed, he's being set up by the customs agents to make a good bust, I guess. Or Waltman knows that the test results, once they come back, are not going to be kind to him. He's embarrassed, and so he made up a story. We'll know soon enough. I don't know when the results will be back, but we'll know soon enough. The results have not yet come back. He also said he took a hair follicle test to prove that he was not on anything and that he hasn't relapsed. I think he said he took a polygraph as well. So this is what Waltman claims how it went down. Now, for what it's worth, I listened to him. I did not listen to him on his podcast, the whole thing. I listened to some of it. I read the transcript of the rest of it. But I did listen to the full interview that he did on the Sam Roberts podcast. He went on Sam Roberts' podcast. He was on there for a long time, probably 45 minutes or more. I listened to that entire interview, and he sounds very convincing. I will say, I came away from it wanting to believe this guy. He says there was no meth. What it was, he says, was candida pills to treat a yeast infection, which is more than I ever needed to know about X-Pac. But he says the pills were to treat a yeast infection he's had for quite some time. He's not sure how he got it. His doctors think it might have been from sex. He doesn't think it was from sex. I don't care. But, you know, he went through the whole experience, what happened to him that day. They were holding him for several hours, trying to get the cops to take him into custody to arrest him. And nobody would take him. He says they knew it was BS, so they knew it wasn't that big of a deal. They didn't have enough to take him in, so nobody wanted to take him. This is what he says. And, you know, the agents wanted him extradited back to Pennsylvania. Like, literally, they wanted to put him on a bus back to Pennsylvania. And they wouldn't take him either. And so I'm listening to this, and Waltman sounds very believable. But I don't know him. the way that Sam Roberts does. I guess he and Sam have become friends. They've hung out over the years. Okay, so he knows him. I don't know Waltman the way that someone like Sam Roberts would, or obviously someone like a Kevin Nash or Scott Hall or someone like that who have been friends with him for a very long time. So I hear this, and the first thing I thought of as I'm listening to this, it made me think of Artie Lang. And I'm not saying that Waltman's drug issues that he had or has or whatever, I mean, he claims he's over all that. I'm not trying to equate his issues to Artie. I think Artie is like, you know, in terms of people who are still among the living, I don't know that there's anybody as worse as Artie Lang. I mean, what this guy has been through, honestly, it is a miracle that he's still alive right now. And anybody that knows anything about Artie and his story will tell you the same thing. Like, the fact that he is living and breathing every single day, he should be getting down on his hands and knees and praying to whatever deity he believes in, because it's amazing he's still around. So I'm not trying to say that they're exactly the same. But for those who don't know, Artie Lang is a comedian. He was on the Howard Stern Show for years. Before that, he was on, I think it was a Mad TV. He ended up on the Howard Stern Show for many years. And he's a drug addict. Total drug addict. I mean, like, heroin, among other things. Really bad stuff that you do not want to get hooked on. He tried to kill himself a couple of different times. He got booted from the Stern Show many years ago. They don't even speak anymore. Then he got his own show. A few months ago, he got arrested again. It seemed like he got his life back on track. He's got some role on some HBO show. I forgot the name of it. And then I read in March that the freaking guy got arrested again. So he's a total mess. And this has been playing out over the last, I don't know, 15 plus years with this guy. And again, you look at him now, he looks like Grandpa Munster. And he's not even 50 years old. Or maybe he is 50 or about to turn 50. And he looks at least 20 years older than he is. And I never listened to Stern every week or anything. I mean, I used to listen here and there when he was still on K-Rock here in New York before he went to satellite radio. My dad was a big Stern fan, especially him for what he did for a living. He was always on the road. You know, he was a truck driver. And so, you know, he went out and bought the satellite radio and he would listen to Stern for 3 or 4 hours, you know, every day. And it kept him entertained. Actually, Noah Mark is a Stern fanatic. So there's a lot of like big fans of his out there. But I was on YouTube a while ago. This is a few years ago. And I have no idea if this is still up. I don't even know who it was who put this together. But it took a long time. It was a lot of work. Somebody put together a series of videos called the Artie Lang Chronicles. And it was 20 hours worth of audio from his various appearances on the Stern Show. It was between a certain time period of a number of years while he was in the throes of his really bad drug issues. And it's just, it's clips, sometimes extended clips from all of the different episodes, stringing them together, trying to paint a picture, I guess, of how bad addiction can be. And it's incredible. 20 hours worth of audio. The point of it was to show this guy's descent into this hell of addiction. And the lies that he told. I listened to all of it. I don't remember how long it took me, but once I started, I couldn't stop. He edited together all of the different appearances, every incident that took place, and then Artie would talk about it on the show. Every time he no-showed, and they would call him and they would get his voicemail. You know, maybe he called in sick, quote-unquote sick that morning. They would play all of this on the air, which was kind of a douchey thing for them to do to somebody who has problems. But so all of this is on there. And he would say, oh, you know, I can't make it in today, man. I'm not feeling well. I got a cold or something. And of course, he didn't have a cold. He was locked in his apartment for 4 days straight, you know, with an eight ball getting messed up. Finally, he'd come back to the show the next week. He'd go through this whole 20 or 30 minute thing about how I feel so much better now and I'm getting help. I'm in rehab, or I'm actually, hey, I'm finally seeing a therapist now. And everyone's like, oh, that's great. That's great news, Artie. That's fantastic. He's like, yeah, you know, I'm feeling better. I'm in such a good place now. You guys don't have to worry about me. And then it would come out that he was full of shit and he was lying. And the stories that he made up, these elaborate stories, they sounded completely genuine. And it turns out he was lying about all of it. Like, really, really sad stuff, but fascinating to go back in hindsight and listen to. Anyway, I know I'm going on a rant here, but I mentioned this only because it made me, as I'm listening to Waltman and I'm believing and wanting to believe what he's saying, it made me think of Artie and how genuine he sounded and how it was all BS and how cynical it makes you. I hate to even say that, but it really does. It makes you cynical because you hear these people, you believe them, you want to believe them, and then in the end, invariably, in most cases, it turns out not to be what they claim it to be, and you feel stupid. You feel stupid in a way for buying into it. And so, you know, I want to believe that Waltman's got his life together. I want to believe that he's being 100% honest. He's in the best shape of his life. That's what he claims. I believe it. You know, he's posted photos online of himself in recent weeks, the ripped abs and everything. He looks great, especially after everything he's been through. And he claims he's on this paleo diet now, no sugar at all whatsoever. He sounds good. You know, he sounds as level-headed now as I've ever heard him before when you listen to him speak. So I hope he's telling the truth. And the agents just wanted to make a good bust. And, you know, maybe they didn't realize how big of a story this was going to turn out to be. Maybe they didn't realize that this guy was kind of like a celebrity in a way, and they just thought he was some guy on a watch list. Who knows, right? And then they figured nobody's going to know, you know, this is not going to draw too much attention. Again, who knows? Who knows? And the fact is, like, if they tried to set this guy up, then those agents deserve to have their badges taken away from them. But if not, if those were not pills that he bought from the vitamin shop, as he claims, then he's in a lot of trouble. Now, it's still pretty dumb, despite all of that, to take all the marijuana stuff on a flight when you're going into another country, right? He says he takes it for medicinal purposes, and so he doesn't have to take opioids and prescription drugs, which makes sense. I mean, the guy's an addict. That's probably a very bad idea. I mean, hell, the majority of this country is addicted to prescription drugs. But you're going into another country. Like, you're transporting this stuff through customs. You're just asking for trouble by doing that. I can't get over how he thought that was a good idea. But I am as anxious as anyone to see how these test results come back and what happens. And look, if the charges get dropped and everything, then hey, they didn't have enough to stick, and he's probably telling the truth. I guess we'll know soon enough. Hey, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter and the Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, thank you guys very much for the PayPal donations. I appreciate it. Kevin Eck. Kevin Eck is a former creative writer for WWE. He now blogs for a website called PressBoxOnline.com. He did a blog this week listing 5 creative pitches that were rejected by Vince McMahon. One of them was for a heel faction of former indie stars comprised of Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Cassius Ohno that would debut on the Raw 1000 show. Of course, that didn't happen. That group later became The Shield, only because Triple H liked Roman Reigns over Cassius Ohno, and so he kind of swapped them out, and the rest is history. Another idea that he pitched, Vince, was for a romantic storyline involving Cody Rhodes and Caitlyn, which Vince shot down because he thought Caitlyn's physique was too manly for men to find attractive, and he wanted the Bellas to be aligned with, I guess, Cody and Damian Sandow. He was teaming up with Cody at the time. He actually paraphrased in his blog, he paraphrased Vince as saying, if one of the Bella twins showed interest in Cody, why would he ever look at Caitlyn again? So that's Vince's views on that whole thing. But there was another idea that Kevin Eck pitched, which would have seen Daniel Bryan commit AJ Lee to a mental institution after their wedding on TV. Remember the whole AJ Daniel Bryan wedding that they promoted on Raw? Only for AJ then to meet her new boyfriend at the Funny Farm in the institution, which would turn out to be Dean Ambrose. And that would be Dean Ambrose's introduction to the main roster. And he and AJ would wreak havoc as a heel couple on Raw, as he says in his blog, similar to Mallory and, what was Woody Harrelson's character in Natural Born Killers? Anyway, he's comparing it to the couple in Natural Born Killers, which was a sick movie, by the way, that a child should not have been taken to, but my dad took me to the movies to see Natural Born Killers when I was like 13, and or actually, I was probably 12. I was probably like 11 or 12. It scarred me for life. Oh my God. Anyway, I read this and I'm thinking to myself, man, that sounds kind of familiar. Like again, it's so many years ago, but I couldn't remember exactly, but it definitely sounded like a familiar idea to me. And I got a bunch of messages from people all of a sudden on Twitter and Facebook saying, hey, Solomonster, isn't this the idea that you pitched 5 years ago on the podcast? And then it jogged my memory and I said, you know what? You're right. But I couldn't remember which episode it was. But you guys are awesome. You came through literally within like 5 or 10 minutes. I had someone telling me the exact episode where it was mentioned. So shout out to Daryl. It was Sound Off 229, way back on July 22nd, 2012. Now, it's not exactly word for word the same idea that Eck pitched here in the blog. I didn't mention the mental institution part, which, by the way, never would have happened anyway, even though Vince rejected it. Just what we know now, AJ Lee talks about her struggle with mental illness in her book. I can't see her agreeing to a storyline where they sent her off to a mental institution. So it probably wasn't going to happen anyway. So I never pitched that part of the idea, but here is what I pitched. I'm going to play the audio for you now, because I love going back in time and just kind of playing stuff like this. So this is what I pitched 5 years ago on the podcast. This was before the AJ Daniel Bryan wedding, where they ended up making AJ the GM of Raw instead. That was Vince's great idea. Hey, let's make AJ the GM instead. And that lasted all of 3 months. Here's what I pitched on Sound Off 229. Obviously, Bryan wants to get his revenge, and so he'll probably change his mind and then run down AJ in front of the world, or something would happen. But what I'm thinking now is maybe to swerve us, not just for the sake of swerving us, but if they actually had a cool swerve. One cool swerve might be the introduction of a new character, and I've talked about this before. The fact that you've got a guy waiting on the bench, ready to play, ready to get in the game. A guy by the name of Dean Ambrose, who, by the way, happens to be very good. If you've never seen him perform, if you've never seen him cut a promo, you can find all sorts of Dean Ambrose stuff. Type in John Moxley, which was his name on the independent circuit, on YouTube. You'll come up with a ton of stuff. The guy is ready to be on TV. And to me, he deserves more than just getting an Antonio Cesaro debut. As good as it is to see Claudio on WWE TV, he's not really doing much right now. And I think somebody like Dean Ambrose deserves more. So what can you do with the guy? How can you debut him where it makes an impact? Well, this might be your perfect opportunity here. Because you've got a lot of people probably, based on the reaction that Bryan got, he has been a heel, who probably think he's full of shit, and poor AJ is in for the embarrassment of her lifetime on Raw this week. Well, what if the tables were turned on Daniel Bryan? This would probably turn him babyface, but it seems like he's going to be turned babyface at some point soon anyway. What if Dean Ambrose kind of crashed the party, and it was revealed that Ambrose and AJ were now together? Because you see, both of them are crazy, and they belong with each other. They're made for each other. And it creates a ready-made feud for Dean Ambrose. You're not going to bring him in and put him immediately in a title feud with, like, CM Punk, because I think I've said before, the risk you run with that, if it doesn't work, is that CM Punk ain't going to get blamed for that. Dean Ambrose is going to get blamed for that. They'll say that the guy's a failure, and then he'll never recover. And I would hate for something like that to happen, but I want him to make an impact in his debut. So I can't think of a better way to do it than crashing the wedding. Turns out there was a better way. It was called The Shield. So, but for the record, I still think that would have been a great idea had they gone with it. Monday Night Raw from this past week, from Sacramento, California. Raw Twitter poll, over 2,300 of you voted. 61% of you voted thumbs up. 39% of you voted thumbs down. Raw did its lowest number of the year, 2.87 million viewers. It was also the third straight week, coincidentally, that the Big Dog did not appear on the show. So, of course, all the Roman Reigns fanatics out there pointed that out immediately and said, see, Roman Reigns is a draw. Raw is suffering without the Big Dog. And maybe there is something to that, right? Can't completely discount that. Obviously, the NBA is kicking all kinds of ass, so that also plays a role in this. And I'm sure Roman is going to be back on TV, especially after that rating. I'm sure Roman will be on TV tomorrow night. He is overseas on the tour. He is in, I don't know where they are today, but they'll be in London for Raw. Actually, I think they're in London for Raw and SmackDown. So if you are one of these people who likes to avoid spoilers, be aware that these shows are taped on Monday and Tuesday, and the results will be online beforehand. So you might want to avoid social media. But we know that Roman is on an overseas European tour because we saw photos of him and Braun Strowman walking around Rome like the best of friends, like their bosom buddies. And people were really upset about that. There's been a lot of debate about that this week. My thought on that is this. So long as these guys are not snapping selfies together and throwing them up on their Instagram page, I don't really see what the big deal is. I like to think, I'm thinking of this in kayfabe form. I like to think that, you know, maybe it's like a Bret Hart in 1997 type thing where, you know, Bret was booed here, but he was cheered everywhere else. Maybe here in this country, Braun is like filled with this uncontrollable rage for Roman Reigns, and he seeks to destroy him every waking moment of the day. But the minute he leaves this country, it's like some portal to another dimension. He forgets all of that, and they're like best friends. So soon we'll see photos of them sharing like a romantic ride on a gondola in Venice, right? Like all Roman has to do is keep this guy out of the country and he'll be okay. But anyway, those ratings, you know, I'm sure it doesn't help. There's one other aspect to all of this with these dropping ratings, and I'm sure this doesn't help. Having a champion who they never even booked to make an appearance. I can't even put all of this on Brock. I mean, Brock only has so many dates, but I'm sure if they went to Brock and said, look, we want you on TV this week. You and Paul, we're going to bring you in for a promo, or we're going to bring you in and have somebody interrupt you while you're speaking and you can just destroy them. Like, do something with this guy. The fact that they don't even book their champion on any of these shows for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks on end, can't even make an appearance. Like, at least after Brock beat Cena for the championship back in, what was that, 2015? They booked the rematch for the following month. They had another match at the very next pay-per-view before Brock disappeared again. It's going to be 3 months between the time that he won the championship this year at WrestleMania and the next pay-per-view where he defends it, which probably is not going to be until Great Balls of Fire, right? Because whatever this Raw pay-per-view is, I think it's Extreme Rules next month. I don't believe that Brock is going to be on that show either. So you're talking about a stretch from the beginning of April to the beginning of July between the time he won it and the time he defends it. That's ridiculous. Yeah, I remember the last time he won it, I didn't have an issue with him not appearing on every single show, but I figured the ones he was on, it would be cool to see him, all right, in between the big, big title matches he'll defend against guys like a Cesaro or a Sheamus. Like, some of these, like, undercard or upper, like mid-card guys that he's never wrestled before, and it would be kind of fun to see him in there. We never did get that Brock Cesaro match, by the way. But I was like, all right, that could be kind of cool. They don't even have any system now to even determine who gets the next shot. So why should the fans care? It's just like he won the title. They don't even acknowledge him. They barely, if ever, even talk about him. It's like he doesn't even exist. That's the part of it I really don't understand. To completely ignore the guy, you would think like he pulled a Benoit or something, but he's their champion. It's very bizarre. The good news is that we got maybe the best Raw main event all year on this show. I can't think of one better off the top of my head. It was a triple threat match between The Miz, Finn Balor, and Seth Rollins to determine a new number one contender for Dean Ambrose's Intercontinental title, since we have a Universal Champion in absentia right now. This came after Rollins had earlier said that he wants the Beast. So they did on this show acknowledge Brock, one of the first times in weeks that they really have. Apparently, I guess he doesn't want to fly to Saskatchewan or wherever the hell Lesnar is living now, because that's about the only way he's going to get near that belt. That brought out Balor, who said he wanted Lesnar because he had that title. He never actually lost it. He was the first Universal Champion. That is true. So then Ambrose comes out. He says that the Intercontinental title is now the de facto top title on Raw. And then Miz came out, and thus we ended up with a triple threat later in the show to see who was going to wrestle Dean for the championship. Fantastic match. Also the first time that we've seen Rollins and Balor wrestling each other since their SummerSlam match last year where Balor got hurt. We've seen them tag before, but not actually wrestle each other. They were fighting for the Universal title, there meaning back at SummerSlam. So it was weird to see them here fighting over the chance to wrestle for the IC title. That was weird. Rollins hit a great frog splash on Balor for a near fall. Got some real height on that. I mean, this guy, he got so high with this thing. Sean Waltman tried to smuggle it through customs. Okay, that's how good this thing looked. Then they had an even better near fall right after that. Rollins had Balor, but he sees Miz climbing to the top rope. So he throws Balor out of the ring. He runs up top. He gives Miz a superplex off the top. Immediately rolls right through into a Falcon Arrow. But Miz kicked out at the last second. So then Rollins goes on a tear. He's doing dives out to Balor. He goes back into the ring. He does another dive out onto Miz. It was like the old babyface Seth Rollins back in the Shield days when he would go nuts and he would just do dives out, you know, every side of the ring and the place would be going crazy. He was a madman in there. But as he got up on that last dive, he stands up and Samoa Joe comes from out of nowhere. And he gives Rollins a urinage on the floor. And that was the end of Rollins. Joe screamed at him, "We're not done yet." Back in the ring, Balor hit a sling blade and some drop kicks on Miz. He goes up top. He's getting ready for the double foot stomp when all of a sudden the lights went out. And when they came back on, Bray Wyatt was standing on the apron. He shoved Balor off, gave him a Sister Abigail. Miz crawled slowly over to Balor, stole the pin. If you really paid attention, I mean, the finish here was never really in doubt. But this was an excellent main event. Nice recovery for The Miz, I think, after being involved in that boring handicap match the week before. I really have not been impressed by what they've had Miz doing since he came to Raw. But this was a nice turnaround for him being involved in a match like this. And honestly, you know, fighting for the Intercontinental title, obviously he's not fighting for the Universal title. Fighting for the Intercontinental Championship and probably taking it back, in all honesty, I think is really where Miz ought to be right now. So that's the perfect spot for him to be in. I do have to say, you know, as time has gone on and he's held that championship so many times, and he did restore it to some level of importance, I think, when he was on SmackDown. I look at that you know, white Intercontinental title now, and the person who I associate it most with, I gotta say, is The Miz. I really do think that he has, it's almost like he has become one, like that's his belt, you know. I will give him credit for that. You know, when I interviewed him at the 2K17 launch last summer, I had asked him about, I don't remember what my exact question was, but he went on this rant in response to something I asked about how, you know, people, everybody says that, you know, the Intercontinental title isn't what it once was, but I've been working my ass off. And he told me that he thinks that he had done a good enough job restoring that belt to a point where it was as important, if not more important, than it was when guys like Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect held it. And that, I think, was a bridge too far. But he believed it. Now, part of it, he was doing his shtick. But, you know, being there face to face with him, it was obvious that he honestly felt that way, that he had done a good enough job of taking a championship that nobody gave a crap about, that used to mean something and used to be, you know, pretty important, and it was a stepping stone for a lot of people to the world title, and he had restored it back to a respectable level. And looking at it now, I can say that, yeah, you know what, he did. He did, and I give Miz a lot of credit for that. He was right. And like I said, I think he ought to probably win the belt back from Ambrose, let Ambrose go off and do something else. But Miz and that title, they kind of go hand in hand, I think, these days. So he is the number one contender. He will be facing Ambrose at some point. Now the drawback is that Miz and Ambrose for the Intercontinental title is a feud that we've already seen. It's not a fresh match. It's not a fresh feud. We saw it on SmackDown already. But there's only so much you can do with Brock not being around. And it's not like Miz and Lesnar is a match that you're going to headline with anyway. That ain't going to happen. You can headline maybe a Raw with it, and the attraction isn't even going to be so much Brock against Miz. The real attraction there would be, holy shit, Brock's wrestling on Raw. So yeah, you can get away with doing that on TV, but not on pay-per-view. But in this one match here on Raw, in this one main event, they set up three matches already for the next pay-per-view. And we still have 4 weeks to go, so that's pretty good. This was easily the best thing on the entire show, but I did enjoy the stuff with the women. Also, at the beginning of the show, they started strong. I think they ended strong with that triple threat match, but that was about it. I think everything in the middle on the show was pretty boring. I don't really have a whole lot to say about, a lot of the other stuff that was on the show. They opened with all of the women in the ring. There was a raised like an Olympic platform in the middle that Alexa Bliss stood on. She is the new Raw Women's Champion. She did beat Bayley for it in Bayley's hometown. This was her coronation as the new champion. She did need that raised platform because, let's be honest, the girl's like 4 feet 10 inches tall. I mean, she's really tiny, so she kind of had to be on. If it wasn't the raised platform, I would have said get her a couple of phone books to stand on. But there she is in all of her glory. And she starts to very sarcastically, condescendingly thank all the other women in the ring. She thanks Mickie James, but she mocked her age and said, "Oh, your contemporaries were the fabulous Moolah and Mae Young." And then she thanks Sasha Banks for being the one that she pinned to get the championship match in the first place. She saw Bayley. Bayley was all sad. She said Bayley's nephews in the audience were crying the night before. Now they have a real role model that they can look up to. And that was all Bayley could stand. She went after Alexa. This huge brawl broke out with all the women. This led to an 8-woman tag. Alexa, Nia Jax, Emma, and Alicia Fox against Bayley, Sasha Banks, Mickie James, and yes, Dana Brooke. Thankfully, she didn't have to do much. Bayley went for her belly to Bayley. Alexa raked the eyes, referee didn't see it. Alexa planted Bayley with a DDT for the win. So the second straight night that she pinned Bayley, who is still owed a rematch. But I like how very quickly that they have positioned Alexa Bliss here on this show as the queen bee of the women's division. I think she's great, and it's nice to see whatever momentum she had on SmackDown actually transfer over to Raw. That did not happen with The Miz, at first anyway. But Alexa has made a seamless transition from one brand to the other, and she's only going to get better. Sheamus and Cesaro, now in full heel mode. They did, in fact, turn on the Hardys. It was just as I predicted last week. I said the Hardys retain, but then they get attacked after the match by Sheamus and Cesaro. That's exactly what went down. So they came out here on the show, they gave their rationale for why they did what they did to the Hardys. They said WrestleMania was supposed to be their moment, and they had that robbed from them when the Hardys came back. Matt and Jeff came out, Matt said they have only one word for them, but they didn't actually say it. Instead, they let the fans say it for them. They did the delete hand gesture, but they didn't say it, but the fans started a delete chant. They ran to the ring, Sheamus and Cesaro bailed. Speaking of the broken gimmick, I may as well talk about this now. We have something of an update on that, and it's not good if you are someone who has been patiently waiting to see them use it on WWE television. You've seen glimpses of it. Matt is certainly dropping little hints of it with the delete stuff and obsolete. He's been dancing around it, but he has not gone full broken yet, and it appears he will not be, at least not for now. The week before last, Impact Wrestling registered to trademark the terms Broken Matt, Brother Nero, Broken Brilliance, and Vanguard 1. So despite all those rumors that popped up a couple of weeks ago before Payback about a deal has been reached and all this stuff, there is no agreement between Anthem and WWE. And in fact, not only is there no agreement between Anthem and WWE, it looks like they're pretty frickin' far from reaching an agreement of any kind. Anthem just will not let this go. Rebbie Hardy went on Twitter intimating that Anthem is now going after her personally. She didn't say exactly how, but she was dropping little hints that, you know, now they're going after her personally. Then on Saturday night, Karen Jarrett seemingly subtweeted Rebbie Hardy. She didn't tag her in the tweet. She didn't tag anybody in the tweet. She literally just posted a tweet that read, "Shut the fuck up," addressed to no one in particular. But I think we all know who it was addressed to. She is subtweeting Matt Hardy's wife. Karen Jarrett wins sad tweet this week. So I sent this to Rebbie. I kind of responded, like I kind of like replied to the Karen Jarrett tweet, and I just made a comment. Yeah, I tagged Rebbie and I said, "Man, you know, I got my money on Rebby here, pregnant or otherwise, I got my money on Rebby. So she responded, I don't know if she had seen it before I tweeted it to her, so she responded back, and this is what Rebby said. She said, funny how everybody is using their at button except the person tweeting. It's at Rebby Hardy in case you have any direct requests, and no, I won't. I guess I won't as in I won't shut the fuck up. Anthem just, you know, they come off, and I say Anthem, I'm using Anthem and the Jarretts. I know they're two kind of different things, but I'm using them interchangeably here. They're all on the same side, so you may as well just lump them all together. Anthem comes off like such a jilted lover in this whole thing. I tell you something, if they put as much effort into making their own product better as they have with this case against the Hardys, they'd be the number one promotion in the world right now. Apollo Crews beat Heath Slater with his spinning powerbomb. Titus O'Neil, who has been recruiting Apollo to be part of his Titus brand, came into the ring for a selfie after the match, and Rhino photobombed them. The Titus brand is about as valuable as the Ico Pro brand right about now, so he's got his work cut out for him to make this work. But honestly, this is probably the best possible use of Titus O'Neil right now. He's been there for 5 years, at least 5 years. He's just, you know, he's not going to get over based on his wrestling skills. Nobody is watching Titus O'Neil because they love his matches. Let's just be honest here. I'm not sure how much better he's going to get after 5+ years working in this company. I mean, friggin' Rosa Mendez spent a decade working for WWE. Somehow she seemed to get worse, not better, as time went on. I don't know if Titus is going to fall into that same camp or not, but the point is, he's got charisma, he's got personality, he's a fun guy. He seems like a really nice, really fun guy to hang around. He can speak. He's got all of those gifts. And if he could get some of that to rub off on Apollo Crews, then this could end up being a positive. Because when Apollo Crews made his debut in NXT, I said that I think Apollo Crews is going to go on to become, you know, some people say we've still not had a black WWE champion. They don't like to count The Rock. I'm not going to get into that whole debate again. Apollo Crews, I really honestly think could be that guy. Whether it's the Universal title, the WWE title, I thought when he initially came into NXT, I looked at him and I said, this guy, he's built like a friggin' machine, right? He's got a great look. He's athletic. He can do things in there as a kind of a bigger guy. He's not tall, but like as kind of a bigger, muscular guy. He can do things in there that I have not seen guys like him do before. He's very impressive. He's very athletic. He's very good. But the one thing he lacks is he really had no personality. He comes out smiling, right? How many times on NXT did I rant about this? He comes out every week, he's smiling, he's showing the big chompers. And I'm like, enough with the smiling, dude. Like, you gotta stop. You just out. And then people started to take notice, and other people started to finally say the same thing. Oh, why is he smiling all the time? He's got his. And finally, it became a running joke on TV, where they started mentioning this is the guy who smiles all the time. They mentioned it on commentary, so. As more people picked up on that, it became obvious that they had to make a change with this guy. Maybe a heel turn, maybe you put him in a group and align him with other people. That is what I think they're trying to do now with Titus. They're trying to just have some of that rub off on him. If he can actually develop a personality, if he can turn into a great talker, two things that I don't think are his strong point right now. He's already got the physical tools, right? In the ring, he's a pretty incredible athlete. I still have yet to see that first true great Apollo Crews match on WWE television. I still have not seen it, but I know he has it in him. But he's got to bring out the other aspects, I think, of that character, of that personality, because he's pretty bland right now. You know, I hear his music and I kind of groan. And it shouldn't be that way. So if that's what they're hoping that Titus maybe can help do, great. I'm all for it. I'm all for it. Because I think that really is the missing piece here to the whole Apollo Crews thing. Kurt Angle came out. He talked about all the injuries that Roman Reigns sustained the night before. He said Braun Strowman suffered a torn rotator cuff. That must be news to all the fans in Europe who watched him wrestle this week. He called their match of Payback the most physical match that he has ever seen. This is what Kurt Angle said. This is a man who wrestled Chris Benoit. His nose grew about 5 inches when he said that. Suddenly the lights went out. out came Bray Wyatt, the eater of pins. I can't get that out of my head right now. He formally introduced himself to Kurt. He said now he's closed the chapter on Randy Orton. He's been reborn on Raw. He said he hears the cries of salvation. He knows what ails each and every one of the Raw fans. He said he can fix it. So he's apparently going to have a chat with the brass at USA Network and knock Raw back to 2 hours. I'll become the biggest Bray Wyatt fan in the world if he could pull that off. He asked Kurt if he would stand by my side, or are you going to stand in my way? And Kurt said, I don't know what you have planned, but this is my show. And Bray laughed and said, yes, but this is my world. And that was that. Every time I see Kurt in the ring with one of these guys from the quote-unquote new era, I can't help myself. I automatically start thinking, okay, is this a match I would like to see? Every time I see Kurt with somebody new on TV, that's one of the first things I think of. Could this be a match? Is this a match I want to see? And so, because, you know, when Kurt does eventually step back into the ring, we know it's going to happen at some point. You know, who do you want to see him wrestle? That's the big question, right? So when he was in there with Seth Rollins a few weeks ago, and remember they were shaking hands in the ring, I thought to myself, yes, that is a match I would like to see. Kurt Angle against Seth Rollins, very good. When I saw him in there with Bray, I didn't have that same feeling. So hopefully this is not some very early foreshadowing into an eventual match, because that is not a match that I care to see. Speaking of Angle, Goldust and R-Truth walked up to him backstage and asked for a tag team title match against the Hardy Boys. Kurt correctly pointed out that their win-loss record sucked. He was a little more diplomatic about it, but I'll say it. It sucks. As if that's ever been a prerequisite for anything on this show. Finally, though, some common sense from some authority figure. But he did say that, I'll tell you what, next week we're going to have a tag team turmoil match to determine the new number one contenders for the Raw Tag Team titles, and you guys can be part of that match. So it's going to be the Golden Truth, and I would assume Sheamus and Cesaro and the Club and Enzo and Cass, I would guess those would be the teams. I don't know who else there is. Then we had the Triple Threat main event, which I already talked about. That made the entire show. Go out of your way to watch it. You know, if Raw is on your do not watch list every week, like they have a do not call list in this country, right? The certain telemarketers are not allowed to call you if you put them on the list. I think that a lot of you guys have a do not watch list, and Raw is probably at the top of it. If so, definitely make the effort to find this match and check it out. You know, they slip a gem in there every now and then, and this was definitely one of them. Hey, Raymond the Mountie Medina, thank you for the donation. You are a beast with them every week, so thank you, Raymond. SmackDown Live from Fresno, California this past week. SmackDown poll, over 1,600 votes. 80% thumbs up, 20% thumbs down. But not all good news. For the second week in a row, SmackDown earned its lowest rating of the year. Are people not feeling the power of the Maharaja? Is that what's going on here? Are they trying to hinder the gender? Randy Orton and Nakamura were both no-shows this week. They were not on the show, which I'm sure that didn't help, nor did the NBA game, so got to cut them a little bit of slack. As expected, they did switch the title back to Kevin Owens. It was Owens against Chris Jericho in a rematch from Payback for the United States Championship. Owens won straight up with the pop-up powerbomb. They did a heavy injury angle after the match to explain Jericho's absence. He's now back on tour with Fozzy. As Jericho was being checked onto the ring when the match was over, Owens ran back in. He gave him another pop-up powerbomb. He went to go throw him into the ropes for a third one. Jericho just collapsed. At that point, seemed like it was over. Owens posed with the belt. We figure, okay, that's it. More referees came down to help Jericho when all of a sudden, Kevin Owens runs back out and he attacks Chris Jericho again. He grabs a chair, he wraps it around Jericho's neck, and he sends him face first into the ring post, I guess jamming the chair into his throat. Jericho went down with a bloody mouth or a lip, I couldn't really tell. This was well done. This was very well done. It makes Owens out to be a sadistic SOB. And the U.S. title headlining this show again makes me think that Kevin Owens and AJ Styles are going to be headlining the next pay-per-view, not Jinder and Orton. Which is weird, because if that happens, we would then have the United States Championship and the Intercontinental Championship being positioned on Raw and SmackDown as the two top titles in the company at the same time. Who would have ever thought that would happen, right? I mean, every now and then they get like a bug up their butt and all of a sudden we'll see John Cena with the U.S. title and it's like that's the most important thing, or all of a sudden they'll give a little boost to the IC title like they're doing on Raw now. For this to happen simultaneously, though, is very weird. Randy Orton may not have been there, but Jinder was, with the Singh brothers in his corner for a match against Sami Zayn. Sami hit a tornado DDT. He set up for the Huluva kick, but the Singh brothers pulled Jinder out of the ring. One of them did. The other, behind the ref's back, grabbed Sami by the leg. Jinder came up from behind with the Cobra Clutch slam for the win. Pretty basic stuff. I've still seen nothing out of Jinder Mahal that makes me want to see him challenging for the championship, but they've got 2 more weeks. They've got 2 weeks left to go to convince me that this guy should be taken seriously in this spot. They had a segment where Becky Lynch ran into the welcoming committee backstage, which has to be one of the worst names for a faction that I have ever heard. Apple is probably still the worst. Actually, the Core was pretty bad, too. We had Apple, and we had the Core. So, anytime you kind of stop and think to yourself, man, things are really bad right now creatively in WWE. This has got to be the worst time ever in WWE. Just remember that there was a time that we had two factions on TV, on two different brands, I think. One called Apple, and one called The Core. That was their clever idea of being creative. So just always remember that. And they spelled Core with 2 R's, too, because I guess they were dyslexic. So the welcoming committee is comprised of Natalia, Carmella, James Ellsworth, and Tamina. Quite the motley crew here. They told Becky that she should be the one getting title shots, not Charlotte. They asked her to join their crew, and Becky said, I'll think about it. They had a video package for Shinsuke Nakamura, and they showed Dolph Ziggler backstage watching on a monitor, and actually staring straight into the monitor. They filmed it from like behind the monitor. It looked like he was looking directly into the monitor. God, I love SmackDown. He wrestled Sin Cara later in the show. He beat him with the super kick. Sin Cara, by the way, he's got some sick-looking new ring gear. Looks awesome. He looks like something out of a Tron movie now. It's too bad it didn't come with a special power to make him suck less. Unfortunately, he still lost. Natty and Carmella beat Naomi and Charlotte. The heels had beat up Charlotte backstage before the match, so this was a handicap match until Charlotte finally came out. Naomi hit the rear view on Carmella, but Natty distracted the ref. Naomi kicked her to the floor, but then Ellsworth got involved. He distracted her, which led to Carmella rolling her up for the win. And the heels beat Naomi and Charlotte down after the match until Becky Lynch ran out. She hesitated at first. All the heels lined up. They were extending their hand to her in a show of unity. And Becky began shaking their hands one by one to make you think, oh my God, Becky Lynch has now joined this horrible new faction. But then she grabbed James Ellsworth and kind of threw him into the rest of them and attacked them. But the numbers were too much for her to withstand. This was not exactly DDP putting the NWO shirt on and giving Scott Hall a diamond cutter, but it did get a nice reaction once Becky kind of turned on them. She still got beat down, though. They left her laying and the heels stood tall. Other than the Jericho Owens U.S. title match and the injury angle at the end, there was one other highlight on this show. And it involved, of all things, Breezango. They produced this segment called The Fashion Files, which was a spoof on Law & Order. They showed Tyler Breeze reviewing some files in the precinct, I guess. Fandango came over. They had the file on the Usos, or the Uggos, as they called them. They ran down all of their offenses. Hands down, best part of this was citing not just jaywalking as one of their offenses, but Jimmy walking as well. It was so corny, but I laughed. They said the big bust would go down at Backlash. I found this very amusing. I'd like to see them do more of these. I'd like for this to be part of a series. They ended with the Jericho-Owens main event and the injury angle, which I already mentioned. So, a good show. A good show overall. Not a great show, but better than the last 2 weeks of SmackDown. Interesting note, real quick here on 205 Live. I know I don't talk about 205 Live much because I just don't have a chance to watch it every week. I'll watch, you know, bits and pieces of it. I just don't find the show terribly exciting, to be honest with you. But according to a note in this week's Observer newsletter, for the first time since the show debuted, it did not crack the top 20 most viewed shows for the week on the WWE Network. Ouch. They had a bunch of table for threes that made the top 20, a couple of ride-alongs. They even had an older episode of that Monday Night War documentary series. That made it into the top 20, but not 205 Live. Not exactly a great sign of that show's popularity, I wouldn't think. And it's live, no less. They made such a big deal about that show being live, they put it in the name. And still, couldn't crack the top 20. That is not good.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
WWE held their first night of TV tapings for its new UK series last night, coming soon to the WWE Network. Jack was there in Norwich. He's a fan of the podcast, brought his Solomonster Sounds Off sign with him. We'll see if it makes TV when it airs. You bet your ass if it does, you're getting a shout-out, buddy. The big news coming out of the tapings, and this is not spoiling any match results or anything like that, the big news is that there will be a United Kingdom title defense at NXT TakeOver Chicago on May 20th, which I think is awesome. That's a great idea. It'll be Tyler Bate defending the championship against either Pete Dunne or Trent Seven. That'll be determined in a match between the two of them tonight at the second night of tapings. My money is on Pete Dunne, on him not only getting the shot, but also winning the championship at TakeOver. At least I hope so. NXT this week opened with Killian Dane of Sanity in singles action. He got a win over Danny Burch. He beat him with the One-Winged Angel, which he is now calling the Ulster Plantation. Heavy Machinery got a win over the team of Hector Kunzman, or Kunzman, I don't know how you pronounce it, and Ricardo Watts, default guy number one and default guy number two, if this were a video game. These guys, Heavy Machinery that is, not the default crew, they're a lot of fun to watch. Otis, gotta love Otis. Otis picked up both jobbers at the same time. Tucker Knight hit the ropes. He kind of collided with Otis. Otis then falls forward, crushes both guys at the same time, gets the pin. So after the match, they cut their very first in-ring promo. And what a promo it was. This was something right out of 1980s WWF, like a wrestling challenge episode or a Superstars, one of these inset promos. As much as a fan of as I am of that period, if you go back and watch some of those promos from that time, you realize how god-awful they are. They are so cringy. That's what this was in a lot of ways. Here they scripted them to use a lot of food analogies. Because you see, there are a couple of fat guys who like to eat. So we got to talk about food, because it's what we can relate to. Otis, I have to say, is entertaining as all hell. I believe he shouted, "Boom Shakaloo," at one point for no reason in the middle of all this. He shouted, "Steaks and Weights," at one point. Got the crowd to chant "Steaks and Weights." Tucker Knight, who did most of the talking, sounds so much like Jack Swagger, it's scary. Minus the lisp. He doesn't have the lisp. But if I close my eyes and I listen to this, I would swear that it was Jack Swagger who I was hearing. He said that they had disposed of a few appetizers, but now they're ready for the main course. The biggest buffet, he called it. That being the Authors of Pain. The dialogue was bad, but I can't help it. I'm entertained by these guys. I've said this now going back to when I first saw them, before they even made their formal debut. I said I like these guys. And you gotta look at Otis when he stands there, okay? He can't drop his arms to the sides. It's like they're... His arms just sort of hang there, you know? It's like, he looks like my old King Kong Bundy LJN figure. The giant rubber ones that didn't move, that you could kill somebody with if you hit them with it. Bundy's arms, I swear to God, Bundy's arms look just like that. They were like fixed in one position. Go find a photo, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Maybe when I'm done here, I'll find a photo. I'll try to do like a side-by-side comparison. I'll put it on Twitter. But that's what Otis looks like. He looks like a walking LJN figure. I love it. So DIY backstage after this pointed out that they are still owed a fair one-on-one rematch for the tag team title. So they're still sniffing around those belts. Hideo Itami against Kona Reeves. Kona Reeves has that look. I don't know what it is, but he looks like somebody who I think is going to be a big star one day. So go ahead and timestamp this. We can come back to this 5 years from now, and hopefully I'm right. But I think this guy's got a lot of potential to be a top guy, and I just think he's one to keep an eye on. He went right after Itami before the bell. He nailed him from behind. This was after Bobby Roode had given Reeves a little pep talk backstage before the match to help motivate him. So I don't know what he said to him, but he lit a fire under his ass. He went right after Itami. Unfortunately for him, all it did was piss Itami off. Itami was kicking the crap out of him, and then he picked him up, gave him the GTS, and that was it. We got part two in the series on Roderick Strong. Again, really good stuff. This one focused on him more as a family man, not so much his background. We got to see his fiance, Marina Schaefer. Is it Schaefer or Shafir? I don't know how you pronounce it, but if that name sounds familiar, she is an MMA fighter. In fact, she was part of the original Four Horsewomen with Ronda Rousey. She's one of Ronda Rousey's friends. This is before WWE decided to steal the name from them. They showed her pre and post pregnancy here in this video. I believe she had the baby a few weeks ago, baby Troy. So they have their first child. This was really good. I've learned more about Roderick Strong and his background, his life and his family and what makes this guy tick, than I ever knew before. I mean, this really set him up as somebody who he does it all for his family. He does it for his fiance. He does it for his kid. He does it for his mom. So this was really good stuff. Bobby Roode backstage told William Regal that Hideo Itami is dangerous. He does not deserve a shot at the championship at TakeOver. And Regal said, you know what? You're right about one thing. He should have to earn his opportunity. And so next week on NXT, it will be Hideo Itami one-on-one against Roderick Strong. And the winner will meet Bobby Roode for the championship at TakeOver in Chicago on the 20th. Main event was a women's number one contenders battle royal to determine who faces Asuka at TakeOver in Chicago. I feel like we saw like five different number one contenders matches on TV this week. Does it feel that way? We had the main event on Raw. We've got the tag team turmoil match coming up this Monday. We had this battle royal here on this show. Did they have anything on SmackDown? I can't remember if they had anything on SmackDown. Maybe not. Maybe they didn't have anything on SmackDown. So many number one contenders matches here. At least they're making the attempt, right? That's improvement. They're not just assigning random title matches to people. So, I don't know half the women who were in this thing, I'm going to be honest with you. I've seen some of them before, but I don't really know who they are. I know Rachel Ellering, she was in there. Daria Baronato was in there. Apparently now she's going by the name of Sonya Deville. They changed her name. Kimberly was in there, as was the debuting Candice LeRae, who got a very nice reaction from the crowd at Full Sail. They knew exactly who she was, although she didn't get an entrance. So they started giving entrances to some of these women, then they went to commercial, and when they came back, Candice was already in, so we didn't get to see her make an entrance. We also had Aaliyah, Liv Morgan, Peyton Royce, Billie Kay, Ruby Riott, Nikki Cross, and Ember Moon. And it came down to Ruby, Nikki, and Ember as the final three. Ember hit the eclipse on Nikki Cross. She went up top for one on Ruby. But when she went up top, Asuka ran out wearing jeans. Which is just funny seeing her running around out there wearing jeans. She ran out there. She shoved Ember off the top rope. When she did, they rang the bell. I was very confused when I saw this because that is the first time I can ever remember, I think, in my entire life, seeing a battle royal that effectively ended by disqualification because somebody interfered. I don't think I've ever seen that before. Obviously, they wanted to set it up so where all the women would end up in a match at TakeOver. That's why they did it this way. But I just in a battle royal, I can't think of a time I've ever seen that outcome before. Now, this was where Ember may have suffered an injury. Remember, I talked about this a few weeks ago. It looked even more brutal here. Asuka grabbed Ember Moon. She sent her flying, almost like as Mauro Ranallo would say, tope suicida, mamma mia, right through the bottom in the middle ropes. And Ember went flying, and she collided with the guardrail. She landed very awkwardly right on her shoulder. She was favoring the shoulder. There's been some debate about whether or not it's a worked injury. Is it a legitimate injury? I would not at all be shocked watching this if this was a legitimate injury that turned out to be minor. And so they haven't said anything about it. They figured by takeover, she'll be good to go. Maybe she tweaked her shoulder. I think that's probably more along the lines of what happened here. I think if it was a major injury, we would have heard about it by now. They would have announced that she's out of the match at TakeOver. They would have put something on WWE.com. They have said nothing about any sort of injury to Ember Moon. I know there was a group photo that was taken with all the people at the Performance Center a couple of weeks ago, and Ember had a sling on her arm. I also know that at the NXT House Show in Phoenix, apparently, this past week, they were advertising the two top matches for TakeOver. They put them, there was either a poster or they put them up on a screen, and it showed that the Women's Championship would be defended by Asuka against Ruby Riott and Nikki Cross, and there was no Ember Moon. It looked like a three-way. Even though when this was over, William Regal confronted Asuka backstage, and he said, at TakeOver, you're going to defend your championship in a fatal four-way against all three women. So that match has officially been set up, but yet in this ad here at the Phoenix show, they showed Asuka, they showed Ruby, and they showed Nikki, and they did not show Ember. So I don't know what's going on. As of now, it is still scheduled, as far as anybody knows, to be a fatal four-way. I guess we'll find out very shortly. Asuka also beat up Nikki and Ruby while she was out there, and then again, she got confronted by an angry William Regal in the back. A few weeks ago, I got asked, if not Ember Moon, who would I like to see take the championship from Asuka, if anybody, or do I want to see Asuka just go up to the main roster undefeated? My suggestion was that if Kairi Hojo was in that women's tournament that they're doing this summer, have her win the tournament and then wrestle Asuka in Brooklyn in August for the championship and have her be the one to take the title from Asuka. Well, just this weekend at the Stardom show in Japan, Hojo announced that she is, in fact, leaving the promotion. She never mentioned WWE. She never mentioned NXT. She never said where she was going. But the belief is that she is headed to the Performance Center very shortly. And so she is on her way. And that is a match I would definitely like to see. Adam Cole is now a free agent. His contract with Ring of Honor expired this past week. He supposedly got, I think he's got one date left with PWG on May 19th. May 19th, don't tell Kane. Of course, May 20th just so happens to be TakeOver in Chicago. Now, in the past, we've seen guys like Bobby Roode and Drew McIntyre sitting in the front row, and that's how they debut them. They want to get people talking. Oh my God, look who it is sitting in the front row. Might we see Adam Cole sitting in the crowd in Chicago? I would say there's a pretty good chance of it. More so than him, you know, running in and interfering in a match or something. I would not at all. In fact, I expect it. I expect that at TakeOver in Chicago, they will cut to the crowd at one point and there will be Adam Cole and people will lose their minds. He has said to be considering both WWE and New Japan. Supposedly, it's not a done deal that he's coming to WWE. I was going to say, you know, if he goes to New Japan, he's got the Bullet Club, right? But he already got kicked out of Bullet Club. So, what else is there really for him to do in New Japan? I mean, he could have great matches, but Bullet Club seemed to have been a good fit for him. He got kicked out. What are you going to do, put him back in? I think he ends up in NXT. I think that's the best place for him. I think he ends up in NXT. They've had their eye on him supposedly for a very long time. I think he'll do very well there. I think he will, I think he'll get over as a star. Now, I was going to do another say something nice about Impact segment this week. This would have been week two. But honestly, the Broken Hardy bullshit just makes these guys look so bad. And not for nothing. Their TV show this week was pretty awful. They had a good match between Matt Sydal and Eddie Edwards, but that was about it. It's not even worth doing a segment this week, so we'll try again next week. Billy Corgan, who knows all too well about how well they treat people there in Impact, and at one point he was trying to take over Impact Wrestling and kind of boot Dixie out of the way, he has agreed in principle to purchase the National Wrestling Alliance. Now, at first, it was funny. I heard, you know, Billy Corgan in the NWA, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, was he going to tour with, you know, Ice Cube or something? But no, I mean, he bought the wrestling the National Wrestling Alliance, or is about to, is in talks to, is in some sort of an effort to buy the name and the trademarks, and I guess also the iconic NWA Championship belt. All of that would come with any deal that's reached. What is not apparently included in this deal is any video library, which is kind of weird, because you would think that would bring the most, besides the name, that would bring the most value, but apparently that is separate. That is, they have their own NWA video on demand service, and that's going to continue on as is, and that is not part of this deal. Dave Lagana, who I interviewed here on this podcast only a couple of months ago, great interview, you can find it, it's up on our YouTube channel. He had just wrapped up work at that time on a YouTube project that we talked about that he did with Billy called 30 Days, where he and Billy hit the road cross country and they traveled and he recorded all of it. And they posted a series of 30 video diaries on the Smashing Pumpkins YouTube channel. It was a very entertaining series. It was very unique. It was something different. And I remember talking to Lagana at the time. And, you know, privately, he told me that part of the goal with that project, it was almost like it was a test more than anything else. Billy had done something similar to that before, so he wanted to do it again. But more than anything, they wanted to try that format and see how that might apply to other things in the future, including possibly pro wrestling. The way they shot that, they were thinking that there may be a way to apply that in some form to professional wrestling. So that's what he had told me at the time. So I knew they were looking to get back into wrestling in some form or fashion. I just didn't know how. I don't even think they knew how. Now it looks like things might be becoming a little bit clearer. They have no plans at this point to run any shows this year. Doesn't mean it won't happen, but that's not something they're thinking about right now. They're just trying to get the sale done. And then they'll come up with a strategy as far as what they intend to do. Now, Lagana did talk to The Observer. He told The Observer that they had bought the brand for a very affordable price, and that one of their ideas is to produce video content that tells the story of the old NWA, which I would imagine is going to be somewhat hard to do if they don't have any video footage. Billy is a wrestling fan. He's a wrestling fan. He ran his own promotion at one point. He pumped so much money into TNA, only a wrestling fan would even think of doing that. Any rational, smart business person would look at Impact and they would run for the hills. But this guy was all in, okay? So he's a wrestling fan. He's a creative guy, obviously. Lagana is somebody who is very up on the latest technology. He's got that going for him. I'm curious what they have in mind. The NWA as a brand is not what it used to be. Can they revive it? Can they make it mean something again? Is this going to be a full-blown promotion or not? It's too early to tell. But Billy Corgan is a fan. He is a legitimate wrestling fan. If he's doing this, he's not doing it just to buy up a bunch of trademarks. He's got something in mind. We have yet another update from Katsuyori Shibata on his condition after that devastating headbutt in the match against Okada. He is still in the hospital. Only family has been allowed to see him. Now, this is translated from his Real Talk blog, which is where he spoke out last time. So again, this is directly from Shibata himself. He said, "It is a miracle to live right now. I had my skull removed. Jesus Christ. In my last surgery. I have another surgery scheduled for May 2nd, and I will return. I have another..." I already read that. Said, "Every day using pain stopper 3 to 4 times. I endure the pain. I can hardly see out of my right eye now. Currently, the hearing ability of my right ear is not normal and the sound is broken." So what I got out of that is he's nearly blind in one eye and he's nearly deaf in one ear. And he had part of his skull removed in that first surgery. But he vows to come back. He vows to return. You know what? Whatever he needs to use as motivation to get better, then go for it. You know, all the power to him. But I would not want to be the wrestling company that clears him after something like this. I would not want that responsibility on me. New Japan might feel differently. They may not. They may never let him wrestle again. I don't know. But if that's me, it's too risky. Way too risky. No word on how that second surgery went on Tuesday, by the way. He said May 2nd. That would have been Tuesday. I've not read or heard anything new about that surgery, but hopefully everything went well. Hopefully that's a good sign and not a bad one. By the way, June 11th in Osaka at New Japan's Dominion show, the rematch is official. Okada defends the championship, the IWGP championship, against Kenny Omega in a rematch from what some people thought was the greatest match of all time. I wouldn't go that far, but it was a hell of a match. Easily the match of the year so far. Omega's coming to Long Beach as the IWGP champion. That's my prediction. I know I'm not going out on a big limb here. A lot of people probably expect him to win the championship as well. But yeah, he you know, they're having these shows. They're trying to break into the U.S. market. So they have these shows in California at the beginning of July. They're coming to Long Beach. I think it's for two nights. I would be shocked if Omega does not walk in to those shows as the champion. So this is going to be good. No doubt about that. This is going to be good. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have them, you could always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Mr. England says, I love the show. Keep up the good work. I am a reasonably new listener from England, so I thought I'd send you a message to say once I discovered your show, I was hooked. Great content. A shout out on the show would be cool. Well, thank you, Mr. England. It's very good to have you on board. We've got plenty of room here aboard this ship, so welcome. Pierce from Boise, Idaho. Do you think Finn Balor would have been a better opponent for The Undertaker at WrestleMania? It would have been a proper passing of the torch since both of them share dark characters. The match could also build next year's main event with a big coronation for Balor. Well, you know, Balor's not the one being coronated next year. It's Roman Reigns. So that's why they went with him against The Undertaker. But you know what? Let me ask you this, okay? Honest question here. And I like Finn Balor, right? I get ripped apart by people who can't understand how I like Finn Balor. Oh, he's small, he's boring, he's a vanilla midget, blah, blah, blah. All the usual idiotic things that people say. So let me just say that right off the bat. I like Finn Balor. But let me ask you this, and this goes out to everybody listening. You say that Balor and The Undertaker both have dark characters, right? What exactly is so dark about Finn Balor? Can you answer that for me? I know he's only been back for a month, but even before that, like, what exactly has he done to make you think that he's dark? I see this guy on social media. He seems like a really nice fella, right? He does that Finn freeze wherever he goes. He's always smiling. And then on TV, he comes out with the leather jacket. He's popping his collar like some Irish Fonzie. I enjoy his matches. I think he's a great wrestler. I think he's really talented. There was a time where I thought that the Dead Man and the Demon could be marketed as something. I still think that the Dead Man and the Demon is something they can market. But they've done absolutely nothing to differentiate the Demon from Finn Balor. Other than the paint and the headdress that he wears when he comes out. I said this like 2 years ago. Do something to set the Demon apart from plain old Finn. They still haven't done that. We have not even seen the Demon since he came back, which I'm okay with. I think they ought to save the Demon just for the big pay-per-view matches. But when we see the Demon again, he's going to hit the same sling blade. He's going to hit the same corner drop kick, the same double foot stomp. There is absolutely nothing unique about the way that he or they or whoever's responsible for this treat that character other than the paint. You know, like, I look at a guy like Triple H. Triple H has two theme songs, because one just ain't enough. He's got two theme songs. He's got The Game, which you know is his wrestler theme, and he's got The King of Kings, which is his executive, hey, I'm in a suit theme, okay? Even something like that, if they did something like that for Balor, and I like Balor's music, but just to change it up a little bit, right? Where maybe he gets darker music for the Demon. Something, anything, to differentiate the two. A new finish. One that he only uses as the Demon. That, to me, would be the most logical thing. But right now, there is absolutely nothing different about the two of them, and usually we see Finn, not the Demon. So when you say he's dark, I ask you, what's so dark about this guy? Because I must be missing something here. Justin from Tempe, Arizona. People want Roman Reigns to turn heel. With him being better in a group, do you think that if they turned him and put him in a stable, that it would be being with the Authors of Pain would be a good idea once they get called up to the main roster. Sure, why not? Right? They already dress like him. Only problem with your idea is that Roman ain't turning heel. John from California. Now that the New Day has broken Demolition's record as the longest reigning tag team champions in history, do you see the Honky Tonk Man's 15-month reign as Intercontinental Champion being broken in the modern era? If so, who do you think on the current roster could fill that spot? I don't see it happening. I think even CM Punk going 434 days with the WWE title was a fluke. It was just to get to The Rock. It was a matter of scheduling, right? I mean, were it not for that match with Rock that they were trying to get to at the Rumble, there ain't no way that Punk would have held that championship for as long as he did. But if it were to happen in today's WWE, if it was gonna, you're gonna have somebody be Intercontinental Champion for a year and a half or something, I think it has to be The Miz. It goes back to what I was saying earlier when I was giving some praise to The Miz. You know, he would be the guy. He's had that thing now, what, like six times, I think? He's probably the closest thing to a honky-level heel that they have. He's great in the role. If anybody on that roster could hold that thing for 15 straight months and get the fans to just beg to see somebody beat him for it and then in the end put over a new star in the end, kind of the way Honky did with the Warrior, it would be Miz. I could totally see him in that role. I think that is the role for him, and I hope he takes it from Ambrose when they have their match. Terry from Blacksburg. I've made it a goal to watch not just Raw and SmackDown each week, but to change it up and see what else is going on in Ring of Honor, Lucha Underground, and Impact. While watching Impact 2 weeks ago, I was met with shock at the debut of Kongo Kong as he attacked Braxton Sutter. The shock came not from the attack, but from his physical appearance. Now granted, I've never been one of those looks or everything guys, because I love guys like Mick Foley and Samoa Joe. However, I found Kongo Kong, billed as being a killer, to look ridiculous, and his attempt at Kevin Owens-like cannonball was as weak as I had ever seen. Tell me, Solomonster, do you see something I don't? Why would Jarrett push a guy like this? He has to be insane if guys like this are his plan for the future of Impact. So that's from Terry, clearly not a fan of Kongo Kong. I'm a fan of all types also. But I'll be honest with you, I had never seen Kongo Kong before, and when I first saw him on Impact, I thought it was embarrassing. That was my first thought. Now, I looked the guy up, because again, I didn't know much about him. I looked him up. He's 37 years old, so he's been doing this a long time now. He debuted the same year Austin versus McMahon became a thing. That's when he made his pro wrestling debut. But I've heard people say that he's super athletic. He's a super athletic big man who does moonsaults and stuff like a modern-day Vader. I just don't see it. But I've not seen enough of his work, I think, to really judge fairly. Plus, and I said this about Umaga when somebody asked me about the Battle of the Billionaires a few weeks ago, while I thought Umaga was awesome, that I couldn't take him seriously in that role because this was supposed to... You had Trump and McMahon, and this was a big, like, mainstream media deal, and you've got this Samoan Savage straight out of 1986, and it just, he seemed miscast, and I thought it painted wrestling in a bad light, and it just, I couldn't take it seriously. I thought it was ridiculous. Just the whole Savage, wild man thing, I don't buy it, right? Athletically, though, I'd love to see some of these matches that people have talked about where Kongo Kong apparently does all of this amazing stuff, because I've not seen any of it so far. You know, and I did see his match on Impact this week too. And again, I might be missing something here that you people are seeing, but I don't see it. Maybe as I watch more of Impact, I'll see it. But, you know, he's there because he was a Global Force Wrestling guy. He was on the GFW roster. Jarrett brought him into Global Force, and when Jarrett came back to Impact, he brought in Kongo Kong. So he is 100% a Jeff Jarrett guy. That's why he's there. So if that's what you were wondering, then that would explain it. Alex from Topeka, Kansas. I was listening to one of Colt Cabana's recent podcasts with Sammy Callahan, and they were discussing whether indie wrestling would ever get to a point where a guy could make as much as someone in WWE, with Colt saying that as hard as he works, he still does not make as much as a guy like Sheamus. But both seemed optimistic it could be possible. While I highly doubt anybody would be making John Cena-level money, Most indie wrestlers seem to say they're making good money doing what they're doing. One of my predictions for 2017 was that we will see more and more wrestlers leave WWE for the independents. While it may mean less money, it seems like for a lot of wrestlers, the creative freedom, as well as the ability to have more command over their schedules, would mean more to them. Let's see here. Do you think that we will have more wrestlers leaving WWE this year by their own choice to head to the indies, or is it just going to be the rare case every few months? I think that as time goes on, and that includes this year, I think as time goes on, you're going to see not like an exodus. I wouldn't say that, because he's right. At the end of the day, if you can become successful working in WWE on the main roster, be it Raw or SmackDown, even as a mid-carder, an upper mid-card guy, you don't have to be a main eventer, then you can make good money that you simply cannot make anywhere else. And so between that and the merchandise and being in the video game and all that kind of stuff, the potential to make a lot of money is there. And wrestling is a business. You are in it to make money. So I don't think that's ever really going to change, but I do think you're going to start to see more and more guys come to the realization as they see people leave WWE, go work somewhere else, and actually make a decent living for themselves and not have to come crawling back to WWE. As guys see that, they'll realize, hey, you know what? There is life outside the bubble. There is life outside WWE. If I get released or if I'm not happy with what they're doing and I say, you know what? I'd like to leave. It's not the end of my career. It's not the, and that's the other aspect of it too. It's not just that you can probably find work and actually afford to leave the company. There are guys that it's in their best interest to leave the company. Look at a Drew Galloway. I mean, the guy left, reinvented himself, came back now a bigger star, and in the end will probably be making a lot more money than he would have if he would have just stuck around as part of 3MB. So sometimes the best way to get over in WWE or to maximize your income or maximize your potential, if you're already there, but they're not doing anything with you, or you actually think they're damaging your character and your drawing power in some way, is to say, you know what, peace out. I'm out of here. I want out. I mean, it's a hard thing to do. I mean, a lot of these guys, I'm sure, also grew up WWE fans. So if your lifelong dream was to work for WWE and now you're there and you're not happy, it's hard. I mean, it would be hard for me, too, if I was in that position to suck it up and go to Vince or go to somebody and be like, yeah, I want out. Like, this is all I've ever wanted, right? And now all of a sudden I want out. It's a hard thing to do, but sometimes that's what you have to do. That's what's in your best interest. And in the end, if you believe it to be so, you will come out better off for having done that. So yeah, I do think we're going to see more of that, but not in this like exodus where six or eight guys before the year is out are going to do that. I don't think enough guys do that. Because whether they're just afraid or their financial situation is a little unsteady, everybody has their own reasons. But it's definitely something you're going to see more of in the years to come as people see life outside, all the indies doing well, World of Sport trying to get a run at it on TV if other companies get TV deals. Competition, man, is a great thing. That's one thing that's been missing from wrestling for a very long time. Is some real healthy competition. I know WWE likes to squash it wherever they can, especially when it comes to TV. They can only do so much. The more of it there is, the better off that the wrestlers will be. Antonio from Lisbon, Portugal. There are a lot of people who say the hardcore fans are ruining wrestling because they cheer the heels, boo the faces, and turn on everyone. If that's true, then why doesn't that happen on NXT, a show watched mainly by the hardcore fans? Why does this only happen on Raw and SmackDown? I disagree. I don't think it just happens on Raw and SmackDown. I'll use Tyler Breeze as an example. Tyler Breeze was a heel who started to get cheered. I know because I was one of them. I became a big Tyler Breeze fan, but he would go out there and he would get cheered. People came to like the guy. They loved the character, and they started to really kind of dig his in-ring work. So I'm sure if you go down the list, we could probably find some other examples of that as well. Bo Dallas, I guess, maybe you want to use him too. Bo Dallas was pushed as this white meat babyface who was getting booed. And I think only then did they tweak the character and said, okay, look, let's embrace this. But I think part of that is that Triple H knows his audience in NXT. Triple H knows exactly who he's catering to with NXT. He's catering mostly to the diehards. right? Or what they would call the internet fans, which is such a stupid dated term, but that's what they still call them. But he knows that. He's not dumb. He goes out of his way to cater to them because it makes him look good in the end. Oh, Triple H, he's giving us what we love. Triple H, I can't wait until he takes over from Vince. He's not stupid. He knows what he's doing. But Raw and SmackDown, it is a different audience. They have other people beyond the hardcores that they have to try to cater to, kids and families and all that stuff. So it's a different ball game there. And the fans are just, they're a bunch of smartasses. They're there to have fun. Now, the new thing now is apparently every near fall, the referee, and this started over WrestleMania weekend, the referee counts two, and everyone goes, sweet! That's the new thing now, right? That's the next thing that's going to start annoying people. It's just what they do. I mean, that's what people do now, and I don't think there's any going back, right? The genie's out of the bottle. Once people realize they could be part of the show, you can't tell them, you can't be part of the show. You must be quiet. The more you tell people not to do something, the more they're going to want to do it. So that's not going to work. And they're just going to keep doing it. They'll come up with their own chance. They like to be part of the show. They're there to have fun. I think within reason, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm sure there are some things. Like the what chant, that's a personal thing with me. I just think it sucks. I think it's the absolute worst freaking chant to ever happen in wrestling. I blame Steve Austin for that. But, you know, some things are just, you know, look, it's just being done for fun. Sometimes it can enhance the show. It can actually make the show better. But I think that's just the way it is now. I don't think there's any going back. But let's not fool ourselves into thinking that this never happens in NXT. You could definitely find examples of it happening at Full Sail. Duan from Lake Charles, Louisiana. Considering the current promotions today, including WWE, Ring of Honor, TNA, New Japan, Progress, and others, which one do you feel has a real-deal world champion? This is someone who epitomizes the main event, letting you know that a world champion has arrived when they walk through the door. I think that WWE, I think that Impact, and I think that New Japan all have world champions like that right now. We could talk about how ridiculous it is that the champion in WWE never defends the thing, but yeah, the fact is, Brock Lesnar is the most legit guy they have on that roster, and he's their champion right now. So Brock, for sure. Brock's the first person I thought of. Bobby Lashley, I think, has really developed nicely into a world champion. Also very legit, comes from an athletic background, not somebody you'd want to mess with. He, like Brock, has had success in MMA, although not at that same level. So Bobby Lashley, I look at as being one of those kind of legit world, like, someone who epitomizes the look of a world champion when you see him walk in the door. And Okada in New Japan, I think, epitomizes a world champion. The wars that guy has been in, the matches that he's had, he's going to go down as one of the greatest of all time. And he's not even 30 years old. So if I were building my own promotion, I would take any of those three as my world champion to build around. And I think if you did that, you'd be in pretty good shape. Dante from Syracuse, New York. I was watching Judgment Day 04 with the main event of JBL and Eddie Guerrero. I realized that neither man was looked at as a main eventer prior to 2004. Even 3 months before this match took place, JBL was a tag team wrestler and Eddie was still a mid-carder. What highly unlikely superstar do you see becoming WWE champion one day? Before the New Day gimmick, I always saw Kofi Kingston as a future babyface WWE champion. What say you? Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of people who think, even New Day now, New Day's made comments that they want Kofi. They want to see Kofi one day become the champion. The fact that Jinder Mahal is getting a championship match in a few weeks says, never say never. Kofi Kingston may well end up being champion one day. I don't see it, though. I think Kofi's very talented, but I don't see him as WWE champion. If I had to pick somebody, you know who I like both these guys. I like Jason Jordan and I like Chad Gable. I like maybe Chad Gable more. There's just something about him that I love watching that guy, whether it's, whether he's trying to cut a funny promo or working in the ring. But I believe that Jason Jordan is going to be that guy. I think Jason Jordan from American Alpha, is going to one day be that guy. He's going to be WWE champion one day. I think he has all the tools. You know, the one thing he has over Gable that I'm sure they love, he's bigger. He's got the physique. He's got the size that maybe Gable doesn't have in their eyes. So he's got the size. He's got the look. And he's super talented. I mean, he's very, very talented in the ring. And I think that he has made quite the progression from where he was when I first saw him in NXT with the giant afro to where he is now. And he's still very young. He still doesn't really have a ton of experience. So you would think he's only going to get better. So if I had to pick that one person, Jason Jordan would be that person. We have Ivan from Central Islip, New York. I just found out Patrice O'Neill was a writer for WWE. Do you know what storylines he wrote for? I do not. I don't know that he was there long enough to really do much. I remember him talking about producing some backstage stuff, but beyond that, I'm not really sure. Kofi from London. Have you heard the story that Shawn Michaels refused to job to the British Bulldog in the UK, even though the Bulldog had brought along his ill sister to watch the match front row, and she did not know he was losing? Is there any truth to this rumor? Yes, I believe that to be true. It was the first UK-only pay-per-view that they did in 97. It was Shawn against the Bulldog for the European title in the main event. Bulldog was the European champion at the time. He had been told he was winning. He was under the impression anyway that he was winning. He dedicated the match then to his sister, who was dying from cancer, who ended up passing away a few months later. She was in the crowd that night. Bulldog did not win, as we now know. Shawn beat him for the belt. Supposedly, he got the decision changed, or he influenced Vince's mind because he felt it would help put more heat on him and DX if he won the championship in the UK. Which it did. He wasn't wrong about that. But that didn't make it any less awful for the Bulldog. I know him and Brett, apparently all of them were very angry when they found out what happened. I believe the idea or what Bulldog was told was, hey, don't worry about it. You're going to get a rematch with Shawn when we come back for the next UK pay-per-view in 98. You'll win it back there. But by then, Montreal had already happened. Bulldog was out of the company. And it wouldn't have happened anyway because of Shawn's injury, and he left after the back injury at WrestleMania. So it was just a, you know, it was one of those Shawn Michaels stories from back in the day. Just an awful situation for the Bulldog, at least in his family. Nicholas from Ghent, Belgium. When Bret Hart turned heel in his WrestleMania 13 match against Stone Cold, he suddenly turned into a, quote, money heel. His anti-America vibe he held onto had me hooked. Fast forward beyond the Montreal Screwjob and his move to WCW, I personally feel his money heel drawing power dwindled down and his viciousness and anger did not really connect like it did in the months leading up to all of this. This brings me to his Mad TV appearance later that year where he appeared in the so-called Sketch Gone Bad, which made me believe he was actually very angry and fed up with the people on the set. Him not breaking character and acting the way he did had lots of people at the time confused. What, in your opinion, could have been done to keep his, quote, money heel credibility once he arrived in WCW, or at least make him as, quote, hated as he was in WWE? I remember that Mad TV sketch. Even then, I was surprised that many people bought into it and actually thought it was real. It seemed pretty obvious to me the whole thing was staged, but Bret Hart, I guess, did a good job with it. He and Will Sasso actually had a fun little feud going there for a few years. But it's simple, and I'm not really sure why they didn't do this other than politics. WCW dropped the ball on something. Shocking, I know. But you look at who was on top at the time in WCW, it ain't too far-fetched to think that there were probably forces there conspiring against Bret, hoping he would fail. It's very simple. Here's my idea. He comes in as the uncrowned WWF champion. He never fairly lost the title. Everybody saw what happened in Montreal. They know that he never actually lost the championship. He got screwed. He was the champion. As far as anybody is concerned, him coming to WCW, he is the uncrowned WWF champion. And now he comes in all cocky and arrogant and boasting about it and mocking WCW as being the play, you know, this is the place you always heard about where the big boys play and all that kind of stuff. Similar to what Scott Hall did when he first came in. But Scott Hall, the difference is Scott Hall was never WWF champion. Scott Hall was never the guy in WWF the way that Bret Hart was. And so Bret comes in, he's talking smack, and he could, you know, he could even have his own custom belt made. I mean, you could have gone a couple of different ways with this, since he obviously couldn't use the Winged Eagle. But he starts knocking off one WCW star after another, trying to prove that the WCW guys can never hold a candle to him or the other guys up north. And it's not a matter of him endorsing Vince McMahon. Like, people might say, well, why would he do this if the way Vince screwed him? Why is he coming in and praising WWF? It's not him praising or endorsing Vince McMahon. It's, you know, obviously he hated Vince's guts. But for years, Bret was the flag bearer for that company. And so now here he is to prove to these WCW guys that they're all second rate compared to him. So I would have him go after, I'd say have him go after Hogan for ducking him in WWE. But if you want to keep Bret heel for a while, Hogan wasn't really ready to go babyface at that point. So you could hold off on that for a little bit. Let him feud with like Flair, which he did anyway, I guess at the beginning of 98. I think that's when they had their match. It sold out. But let him feud for a few months with Flair. Let him feud with Sting. So they went with Bret as a babyface instead, which I get. They wanted to play off the sympathy for what happened to him. But they wasted all those months of this guy being built up as this great anti-American heel, only to then turn him heel and stick him in the NWO as just another guy. I mean, that's what I don't understand. They paid all of this money to bring Bret Hart in. And I know the stories of WCW wasting millions of dollars and signing people like the genius Lanny Poffo to a contract for six figures, and yet he never even appeared on television. No wonder this frickin' company is out of business. I get all that, but it just, to pay that much money, to pay millions of dollars, like $3 million a year, to Bret Hart to bring him in, coming off of this unbelievable situation that is the talk of all of pro wrestling. You have this guy now under contract in your company, and your first role for him is to make him a special referee, and not even in the main event. I mean, when they had him at Starrcade 97, he was the referee for an undercard match. Now, he did come out to count the fall or whatever in the Sting-Hogan match, but that was a whole disaster unto itself because that match sucked, and Bret came out and punched a referee in the face, claiming the referee fast counted when he didn't fast count. So the whole thing was a freaking disaster. But their big plan for Bret was to make him a referee. That's the best they could come up with for this guy. That's what the geniuses over there in WCW and Bischoff and all of them could come up with. Are you kidding me? So, yeah, I think to say that they screwed the pooch on that one would be the understatement of the year. They had one of the hottest heels in wrestling, the uncrowned champion, walk in their door, and that's the best they could come up with for him. So, I don't understand it, but I could sure as hell understand why they're not in business anymore. Amay from Mumbai, India, buy or sell on which one of these Battle of the Generations at WrestleMania felt more epic to you? Hulk Hogan against The Rock or John Cena against The Rock? Oh, I'm buying on Hogan and The Rock, of course. I mean, the biggest match you could have done was Hogan-Austin, but short of Hogan-Austin, Hogan-Rock was the biggest match you could do. That, to me, was like a clash of civilizations. It wasn't just old versus new. It was like WCW, NWO against WWE. It was a match that you didn't think you would see. Cena and Rock, I mean, it got to a point where it was a match I never thought we would see because I never thought Rock was coming back. And that match did huge business. I'm not saying it wasn't a success, but in terms of which match felt more epic to me, Rock and Hogan by a friggin' mile. So we'll end it there. I think that's enough for now. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I got a lot of stuff. I know I haven't responded to everybody, but just be aware I do see everything you send me, even if I can't respond directly or if it doesn't make the show. I try as hard as I can. But email me there. Follow me on Twitter @Solemonster. Next week, I have a little something special planned for episode 495. I'm looking forward to that. So that's next week. And also, this won't necessarily be a good next couple of days for me. I'm kind of Sam nervous would be kind of an understatement. I have a big test tomorrow, a big bone marrow test tomorrow, actually. I've been putting this off for so long. Man, let me tell you, I am not looking forward to this at all. I have a test tomorrow at noon, and it's not going to be fun. It's not even so much like the results. It's almost more of like checking just to get a baseline reading on what's going on, and also just to clarify exactly like the type of what it is that I have. I mean, I've talked about this before without getting into all of this stuff about the, you know, the blood cancer and all that. So this will hopefully settle this little debate that's broken out between my doctor and there's another doctor who seems to think I have something that's slightly more serious. So hopefully this will settle that debate, but it's just something I've been putting off for like 9 months, and it's at the point now where it's like, all right, I may as well just go ahead and have it done, and it's not a fun test at all. So that's tomorrow. If I'm a little out of it or I'm not as chatty, then you'll know why. I'm kind of a nervous wreck right now. But anyway, that's tomorrow. But next weekend, like I said, I have a little something fun, little fun segment planned for the show next week. So that'll be episode 495 here on our road to 500. I appreciate the hell out of all of you, everybody who continues to donate via PayPal. You guys are fantastic. That is really the main support mechanism for this podcast. Voluntary donations from you guys on thesolemonster.com. But you've been killing it with Audible, so keep doing that. I want to have another big Audible month, audibletrial.com/solemonster. Spread the link too, man. I mean, it doesn't even have to be you. If you have a family member who you think might have a use for it, by all means, spread the link to them and get your free audiobook. Buy a t-shirt in the store, prowrestlingtees.com/solemonstersoundsoff. We've got over 24 designs in our store right now. Thank you, as always, for the support. We will be back next weekend for episode 495. So until then, be well, stay safe, and I'll see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take it easy, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off. What?
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solemonster Sounds Off. Since 2007, The Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster Sound Off.